AA, the program that saved my life, and it's going to save yours too if you want to take some real quick actions. And I suggest strongly that you get a sponsor tonight, that you get that book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and that you get busy and do what everybody else is doing around here, and you're going to stay sober as I've stayed sober for 12 years, and people like me cannot stay sober, I can guarantee you. My home group is the Pacific Group in West LA, a group I'm very, very proud to be a member of, just as I'm sure you're proud to be a member of yours. And my sponsor, Clancy, sends you his love and very best wishes tonight. And if anybody in this room is wondering why I have a man for a sponsor and why I have Clancy for a sponsor, it's really quite simple. I didn't get sober in California. I got sober in a place called Lincoln, Nebraska, which is just a, well, it's just a goddamn terrible place to get sober, if you want to know the truth. And although we are the number one football team in the nation, I will tell you that. And I wasn't doing well in Alcoholics Anonymous in Lincoln, Nebraska. I went through 19 sponsors at a rapid clip, and I'm certainly not proud of it as I stand here tonight, I got to tell you. And thank God for the old-timers in AA, because somebody loved me enough to get me my current sponsor. And I got to tell you that my life has done nothing but totally, completely turn around as a result of it. And I talked to him this morning, as I do every single day of my life, and he said, where are you going tonight? And I said, Sacramento. And he said, well, get up there and share your experience, your strength, and your hope, and tell those people what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. Ignore the old-timers. They have this program. They don't need your inspiration, my dear. And talk directly to those new people who are the life and blood of AA. And I believe that as I stand up here tonight, and I welcome you, and I hope that you stay. And then I think I did, without a doubt, the most important thing I can ever do, and that's to say, God, please help me say what you want me to say to these people. God is very much a part of my life tonight, you guys, and it did not used to be that way for me, I can guarantee you. I come from an alcoholic hell. I cannot even describe it. It was so bad. And, you know, my life is real good today, and sometimes I forget how bad it was. And I can tell you, the day I got sober, I weighed 95 pounds. I was the color of squash. I now call it hepatitis. I had a liver cirrhosis. I had ruptured esophageal varices. And if you don't know what that stuff is, you don't want to know what it is, because you die from that kind of stuff. And I was standing on Skid Row in Lincoln, Nebraska, sucking on a bottle of Mad Dog. And if you guys haven't drank Mad Dog, I need to tell you it's not one of your finer wines, I can tell you that. I'll guarantee you one thing, that crap has never seen a grape, make no mistake about that. And I literally could not believe what was going on in my life. I'd lost my children, I'd lost my husband twice, although I didn't really care about that, I want you to know. I'd lost my car, I'd lost my house, I'd destroyed every relationship I'd ever had with anybody, and I was clearly dying from alcoholism. And then I lost the one thing that brought me to my knees in this disease. I lost my nursing license. And you guys, I love my profession, and that absolutely devastated me, but it did not stop me from drinking. And there's a reason for that, because I have an obsession that somehow, someday, I will learn to control and enjoy my drinking. The persistent illusion is astonishing. Many of us pursued in the gates of insanity and death, just like our book talks about. And I'll guarantee you one thing. I was in the gates of insanity. I got sober and almost into my coffin. And I'm most grateful to stand here 12 years sober tonight, because I really should be dead. And, you know, I want to thank Linda and the committee for inviting me to come out and share my life with you tonight. This is an honor and a privilege. It's one that I do not take lightly, I'll guarantee you. You guys, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I really do. And I think that it shows. And I make an awful lot of mistakes, and I do an awful lot of things wrong. But I'll tell you one thing, that I love you. Make no mistake about that. And, you know, Linda picked me up from the airport this morning, and let me tell you something about Linda. I'd have drank with Linda. I really would have drank with Linda. And there's some people in AA I wouldn't have drank with, I got to tell you. But she's one that I would have, and she's wild and crazy like me, and we just have had a really, really fun time today. And my stomach hurts from laughing all day, if you want to know the truth. And we were laughing at two of the biggest jokes in the world, us, you know. But anyway, I've had a great time today, and I thank her so much for picking me up and stuff. And you know, you guys, I can tell you about my drinking about 2 seconds flat here. About 25 years ago, I was at a little concert in upstate New York called Woodstock, and that's what my drinking was about. It was about Woodstock. And I will tell you, there's only one Woodstock. There will never be another Woodstock. That one last summer was just crap compared to the one I went to, I got to tell you. You know, I come from the roaring 60s, and I love rock and roll, and I love Elvis Presley, and I love Janis Joplin. Janis Joplin was my lady, let me tell you guys. And I had the honor of handing her a fifth of vodka on stage in Kansas City, Missouri one time, and that was my claim to fame for many, many years. And in retrospect, I can see how sick that was. That woman died from alcoholism and drug abuse. But, you know, I love that woman. I wanted to be just like her, and in many respects, I was, I got to tell you guys. And you know, I will never forget what it felt like to stand in front of that stage at Woodstock and hear Richie Havens sing Freedom and Joe Cocker and Country Joe and Santana and all those groups that I loved. And, you know, I was invited to go up there with a medical team of people from the Midwest, and they invited us because they thought we'd be more responsible, and we were a seedy lot, let me tell you. And about 10 nurses from Lincoln, we met about 80 residents from the East Coast, and they were worse than we were, I got to tell you. And by the end of the week, we couldn't find our narcotic keys. We couldn't find our narcotics. We probably sold them is what we did. But, you know, we had an infirmary on that in that back lot in a little semi. in that back lot on Woodstock, and I never saw that infirmary the whole week, I got to tell you guys. And I did not do 1 ounce of work the entire week. And this year, as we all know, Woodstock happened again in July. And this committee that put it on called every one of us, invited us to come back and cover that. And, you know, some people are really stupid, you guys. They just never learn, I got to tell you. And my mean old sponsor wouldn't let me go. Can you believe that? You know, and he told me, he says, don't you have a baby you could be working with? I'm sure you need to go to Woodstock. And that's exactly where I needed to go if you want to know the truth. And, you know, drinking for me, you know, at one time was a fun, fun thing, I got to tell you guys. And I cannot remember the fun, I remember the pain that it caused me. And it almost cost me my life. And I most gratefully stand here 12 years sober tonight. And, you know, like I said, I loved rock and roll. And things haven't changed a whole hell of a lot, I'll tell you. I was at the Stones concert 3 weeks ago. I work at UCLA, and we were covering that concert. And I'm always the first one to sign up for them, I got to tell you. And at the Rose Bowl, and I love all of them. And in case you guys don't know it, if you're going to go to the World Conference in San Diego in July, the kids especially, Metallica and Guns N' Roses are playing for that, so you'll have to be sure and come to that. But I hate Guns N' Roses and Metallica, I got to tell you. But, you know, whatever fires your rocket. But I love the Rolling Stones, I got to tell you. And Mick Jagger and I are both 50 years old, but just barely, I want you to know that, just barely 50 years old. And I can't believe that a lot of us have even survived that era, I got to tell you guys. But anyway, you know, I come from an alcoholic home, and I don't think that's neither here nor there. I don't do well with people that stand at AA podiums and blame anybody for anything. And my dad was an alcoholic, you guys, and I loved my father very, very much. And my dad died from this disease on the streets of Chicago in 1979. And you tell me how a major in the Air Force dies on Skid Row. I don't know how that happened, other than the fact that he was an alcoholic. And whether or not he ever found AA or not, I do not know. I just know that he certainly did not stay sober as a result of it. And, you know, one more time tonight, this is a cunning, baffling, powerful disease that kills people. This is not a game I'm playing up here. This is serious business. I would give anything in the world if my father were alive tonight, because we would have one hell of a lot to talk about, I can tell you. I have a mother who was not an alcoholic, and my mom was always, always so proud her daughter was 10 years sober and Alcoholics Anonymous when she died. And my mom died a year ago in March, and I miss her terribly, I got to tell you guys. And whenever I'd go anywhere to speak, I'd always call my mom and tell her where I was going and stuff. And she'd say to me, why do you have to get up there and tell those people all that stuff about you? They're not going to like you. And I'd always say, Mom, the rottener you are in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more people love you. And she'd say, well, I don't understand that. And I'd say, well, you don't have to understand it. And she'd say, and don't tell those people that you're afraid, because they don't like people that are afraid. And I'd always say, Mom, the more afraid you are in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more people love you. And one more time, she'd say, I don't get it. And why would she get it, you guys? She wasn't an alcoholic. And she'd always end up by saying to me, I'm going to tell you something, young lady. You come from good stock, and we don't air our dirty laundry in public. And I'd always say, Mom, it's not dirty anymore. And she didn't understand that either. But I miss my mom very, very much, you guys. And you know, I'll be forever grateful for that woman for all the things that she did for me early on in my sobriety, I got to tell you. And I have a sister who was Miss Rah-Rah in high school and homecoming queen and cheerleader and all that kind of crap and made straight A's, never cracked a book, and I made straight F's, never cracked a book, and that was the difference. My sister was a beautiful little girl. She's a gorgeous woman today. She looks nothing like I do, I got to tell you. And she was a model for many, many years for Neiman Marcus in Dallas, Texas, and retired here recently, and now she's teaching school in the West Indies. And I got to tell you guys, it is a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love my sister very, very much today, and I recently found out something about her. She's also very beautiful on the inside, too, and I never used to know that. I have a brother who's a pilot in the Navy in Spain who got home from Operation Desert Storm not too long ago, who was in that first attack over there, and I am so grateful that war is over with. You have no idea. Neither one of these people are alcoholic. I have another sister who's married to the public defender in Lincoln who got me out of one hell of a bunch of trouble when I got sober, and I'm welcome in their homes today, and I never used to be. I come from basically a very boring family, if you want to know the truth. They're highly successful people, and they bore me to tears, I got to tell you guys. And I have a couple kids who are 34 and 35 years old, and I know I certainly look old enough to have kids that age, but by God, I am. And this is where it really starts getting interesting for me. These kids are anything but boring, I got to tell you guys. As a matter of fact, they're a couple of jerks, if you want to know the truth. You know, I love my kids very, very much. Please don't get me wrong, but they are indeed a couple of jerks. And my oldest son's an alcoholic, and I know our book says we don't call the people an alcoholic, but I'll call him one if I want to, because he is one. And he got picked up for his number 9th drunk driving charge last March, and one more time he's gotten out of it. It never ceases to amaze me the crap that we get away with, and I know I'm the last person in the world that can help that kid. I can just be an example to him and keep my mouth shut, and that's what I try and do. I have another son who's not an alcoholic, and he's not a drug addict, nothing like that. He's just goofy is what he is. And I love to tell this story because it shows you precisely how my life goes. I got the strangest phone call from this son of mine about 8 years ago in Los Angeles, and he said, Mom, I'm getting married tomorrow. And I thought, getting married tomorrow? It was a surprise to me that anybody would even have him if you want to know the truth. And I said, Jeff, why do you call me the day before the wedding and expect me to be back in Nebraska? I said, the Pope's in L.A. I doubt if I can get a flight out of here. And he said, Mom, I don't expect you to come. It's just going to be a tiny little wedding. Don't worry about coming. You know, you don't tell people like me that stuff. I wanted to be there, and I was right about that. I couldn't get a flight out of L.A. The planes were just jammed and stuff, and I was just in a twit, you have no idea. And I talked to my sponsor about it, and this is the kind of loving direction I get from my AA sponsor. He said, well, what the hell are you going to do? Walk? If you can't go, you can't go. Now shut up about it. I don't want to hear another word about it. And I did. And I talked to my mom the day after the wedding. I said, Mom, how'd the wedding go? And she said, it was very lovely, but who was that little girl with them? And I said, what little girl? And she said, well, apparently Jeff's got a 4-year-old daughter that you don't know anything about, and I suggest you call your son and talk to him about it. And I need to tell you guys that I was more than happy to do that. Make no mistake about that. And I called Nebraska, and I said, Jeff, how'd the wedding go? And he said, it was very nice, Mom. And I said, who was that little girl with you guys? And he said, Mom, that's my daughter. And I said, why didn't you tell me that I had a grandbaby? I was so upset with him. Not because I had a grandbaby, because I didn't know about it. And he said, Mom, I was afraid you'd get drunk. And I thought, get drunk? I wouldn't have gotten drunk with that. At least I don't think I would have. And I was on the first thing smoking out of LAX to get home and meet my little granddaughter. And I got to tell you guys that this child is the icing on the cake. She is the apple of my eye. Her name is Brandy, and doesn't that just figure? You know, and and she walked up to me at the airport, and she said, are you my grandma? And I said, well, yes, I am. And she said, well, you know, you're my favorite grandma. And see, that's what I want to hear. That's the stuff I strive for. And I said, Brandy, why do you say that? You don't even know me. And she said, because you wear ribbons in your hair, and grandmas don't wear ribbons in their hair. And I thought, well, that's about the stupidest thing I've ever heard, but I'll take whatever I can get here. And I flew her out to Southern California about 3 years ago to give me a cake at my number 9th AA birthday, and she flew out from Nebraska by herself, and I thought she'd be terrified to be on that airplane by herself, but I was wrong about that. She got off that plane like she owned it after sitting in the cockpit with the pilot the whole trip, and I knew I was going to be in bad, bad trouble because this little girl never shuts her mouth for 2 minutes, you guys, and I'm not used to being around little kids, and they drive me crazy real quick. And I said, Brandy, do you ever be quiet? You're giving me a headache. And she said, Grandma, I have a lot to say, and if you don't like it, take some aspirin, is what she said to me. I think that we have a prospective member of AA on our hands, or I hope I'm wrong about that. I stood in Lincoln, Nebraska 4 years ago in January, and I looked at my second grandchild, a beautiful baby boy that was born to my son and his wife, and I got to tell you guys, the tears of gratitude rolled down my cheeks because I should not have been standing there. And I stood in Lincoln, Nebraska 3 years ago in January. I looked at my third grandchild, another beautiful baby boy that was born to my son and his wife, and one more time the tears were rolling. And I stood in Lincoln, Nebraska last January. And I looked at my fourth grandchild, another beautiful baby boy that was born to that alcoholic son of mine and his wife, and one more time the tears were rolling. Things with my family are very, very good today. It is only a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous, I can assure you, and it took a long time for it to happen. And in my case, that's a good thing, I got to tell you guys. You know, when I was growing up, I was a disruptive jerk is what I was. Always in trouble, always getting kicked out of classrooms. I hated discipline. I was very, very rebellious. I literally hated people telling me what to do. And I like it even less today, if you want to know the truth. And, you know, I never felt like I belonged anywhere. And I hear that a lot from AA podiums. And I'm right on with that 125%, I got to tell you. You guys, you know, I really don't remember my first drink. But I can tell you that I hope to God I never forget my last one. And I hope it was my last one. But I remember what alcohol did for me from the very beginning. It made me feel like I belonged, that I could be anything I wanted to be. I could do anything I wanted to do. I drank at any given opportunity after that. And I was probably about 13 years old. You know, I realize that I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight, and I honor that. I identify myself as an alcoholic from this podium. I used a lot of drugs, too. I need to make that a small part of my story. My sponsor encourages me to do that. And, you know, when I was growing up in Nebraska, there just wasn't a hell of a lot of drugs on the street. But I'll guarantee I found every single one of those drugs. And, you know, there was some marijuana and speed and stuff. And today, if you get caught for possession of marijuana, you get a ticket, big deal. When I was growing up, you went to prison is what happened to you. And that didn't scare me. Nothing scared me. Everything I wasn't supposed to be doing. And I'm one of these alcoholic females, and I hate to say this from an AA podium, but it's precisely the way that it was for me. And we're supposed to tell the truth up here. And if you pat me on the head, my pants fall off is what happens to me. And I got myself into a lot of trouble when I was growing up. Yeah. I absolutely love men. I love everything about them. You name it about it, and I love it about them. They've been the downfall of my entire existence, and they remain the same today, I'm sorry to say. And I particularly like sick men. And there's a room full of them here tonight. I can just feel it, you know. And, that's one thing I love about California. It's got so many sick men, and I'm just entertained around the clock 24 hours a day. And I'm getting the age now. Girls with silver-haired men are starting to become very attracted to me, which opens up a whole new ball game, I got to tell you. Another 20 years of grief coming up, I'm quite sure. And, you know, those young ones are nice, but sooner you get to talk to them, and they ain't got nothing to say I want to hear, I got to tell you. And I'm sure that I have nothing to say they want to hear either. But I got to tell you guys a funny story. I was in Nashville, Tennessee about 2 years ago giving a talk, and one of the fine ladies of Nashville, Tennessee walked up to me afterwards, I want you to know, and she says to me, she says, "You're disgusting." And she wasn't kidding you guys. She meant every word of it. And I said, "Lady, from where I come from, being disgusting is a step up, I got to tell you. And furthermore, if I wanted you to sponsor me, I'd flown to Nashville and asked you." You know, I hear some women get up this podium, you guys, and I wonder if they ever drank. I really do. I wonder if they didn't do all their drinking in one room and somebody didn't shoot it to them through the keyhole with an eyedropper. You know, I was out there big time. I got myself into a lot of trouble. I've been taught to share that freely in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I offend anybody in this room tonight, I would never offend anybody in the program that saved my life, I got to tell you. And besides that, my book tells me, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me, and this is my favorite part of the book, it says, cling to the thought that in God's hands, your dark past will be the greatest possession that you have. And then it goes on to say, because you can literally divert death and misery for others. And I found that to be very, very true in my sobriety. And if I offend anybody here tonight, I want to hear about it afterwards either. But anyway, I got pregnant when I was 16 years old, and I had to get married. And as it must be, I married an alcoholic. Don't most alcoholic women? I go for colorful, exciting men that beat the hell of you and all kinds of stuff. And he wasn't even a man, you guys. He was only 17 years old. And I was 16. I couldn't cook. I couldn't clean. I couldn't take care of a baby, nor did I want to take care of a baby. And before we knew it, we had two babies to take care of. And I quick found out what caused all that, and I put a halt to it, I'll guarantee you that. And that caused me a lot of trouble throughout the years. And as it must be, I married an individual that refused to work, that drank on a daily basis, and used to come home and beat the hell out of me on a daily basis. And I had never seen a man hit a woman before in my life, you guys. I'll guarantee you one thing. If my father would have ever hit my mother, she'd have knocked him from here to the moon, I got to tell you. And I grew to hate this guy very, very much, and I'm not blaming him for my disease. So please don't get me wrong. It's just part of my story, and I need to share it. And some in that family had to get a job, and I hadn't even finished junior high yet, for Christ's sakes. And I found a job as a nurse's aide at a hospital there in Lincoln. And for the first time in my life, I began to respect and admire something, and it's called nursing. And I had that respect and admiration today, too, by the way. And, you know, little by little, day by day, I was falling in love with the nursing profession. And I made a plan to myself. I would love to go to school, and I would love to become a registered nurse. That's what I would love to do. You know, they say that alcoholics don't have willpower. And I'm here to tell you now from this podium that that is a bunch of crap. I have more willpower than 20 elephants. When I want to do well, I'm going to do well. I don't have any willpower as far as my disease goes, but when I want to do something, I'm going to do it. And I went back. I finished junior high. I finished high school. I went to college full-time for 3 years, and I worked full-time for 3 years. And I'm talking about 18, 20 hours a day, you guys, and that is hard stuff to do. I did not drink. I did not use any drugs during this period of time. At the age of 27 years old, I became a registered nurse. And if you think I'm proud to stand up here tonight and tell you that I got jerked in front of the State Board of Nursing Nebraska, and they told me, you are a disgrace to your profession, you're a disgrace to nursing, you're a disgrace to medicine, and you are no longer working because we just jerked your nursing license. If you think I'm proud of that, you are sadly wrong. You guys, I love my profession, and I really, really mean that. And I would never do anything to jeopardize the people that I take care of, nor the people that I work with under ordinary circumstances. And what I have to tell you tonight is a story about how I threw it right down the toilet so I could drink. And that is total insanity. It's also called alcoholism. At the age of 27 years old, I divorced this man. And girls, I got to tell you that a whole new world opened up to me, and it's called men and alcohol. And I went absolutely hog wild is what I did. I was engaged 8 times during that divorce. I never did marry these people. 2 of them died from alcoholism, for Christ's sakes. You know, I don't know anything about social drinking. I drank, I ran around with alcoholics, and we do indeed die from this. And at the age of 27 years old, I went to work in an operating room there in Nebraska, and I had that job for 19 years. I love working in surgery. I love taking care of those patients. It's a colorful, exciting nursing position, and I drank and I ran around with medical people mostly. They were colorful, intense people. They worked hard and they played hard. And I need to tell you that the incidence of alcoholism amongst the medical profession is tremendously high, and that'll do a lot for your security level if you're going to have surgery next week. But it happens to be very, very true. And those people are so grateful that I'm sober that they can't see straight. And I'm talking about alcoholics is what I'm talking about. You know, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says clearly that we're to tell in the general way what our drinking was like. And you're going to get the general idea real quick about my drinking is like. We have a little town in Nebraska, and it's called Palmyra, Nebraska. And I found out something very interesting one particular night about that town of about 200 people, that they take a dim view of naked women walking on their highways. I found that out. And I'd been to the horse races in Omaha, Nebraska with a couple of nurses that I worked with, and the girls told me, they said, Karen, the horse race has been over with for 3 hours. We're all drunk. Let's go back to Lincoln. And I said, well, run along. I'd met two guys from Council Bluffs, Iowa, and these guys wanted to take me to a party, and by God, I was going. Like I said, you pat me on the head, and I'll follow you anywhere you want to go. And I really can't tell you much about this party, nor the guys that I was with. I just know that I woke up out of a blackout on Highway 2 by that little bitty town at 2 o'clock in the morning, and it was February in Nebraska, and it was a little bit nippy out there in February in Nebraska to be doing that, I got to tell you. And tonight I know why ducks' feathers freeze, I can tell you that. And there I was, walking down the highway, stark naked, my high heels carrying my purse, and I literally could not believe it, you know. And, you know, in our book it talks about Marty Manna wrote the chapter, The Keys to the Kingdom, the first woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I read this in the book, I literally couldn't put the book down. She writes how she had arrived at this tragic impasse she could not have explained to anybody. And I know what that means, let me tell you guys. And I could not have explained that to anybody that night. And all I know is I'd been to the horse races at all I knew. And there I was, and the first person I ran into was a state pig. And, you know, in Nebraska, the cops travel by themselves. They don't have a partner. And in California, they're a little bit smarter than that. And this guy stops his squad car, and he rolls down his window. He turns on his siren, and he looked at me, and he said, what are you doing? And I thought, well, that's about the stupidest thing I've ever heard anybody say. It's quite obvious what I was doing. And he said, lady, you get in this squad car, and you sit down, and don't you touch me. Well, you know, one thing about a person like myself, every time I'm in trouble, I'll do one thing more to make it worse every single time. And I looked at this cop, and I said, I'm not getting in your squad car because you might try and rape me. He said, lady, I wouldn't bet any money on it. You are absolutely disgusting is what you are. And I'm here to tell you guys that that made me madder than anything that was going on to show you how sick I was. And he had to get a matron out from the Palmyra, Nebraska City Jail to come out there and get me. And that woman was not pleased, I'll guarantee you. They were very busy tonight at that downtown jail. They didn't have time for this foolishness. And I went downtown, booked in that cop's raincoat. You know how cops keep raincoats in the trunks of their car for these occasions. And I went downtown, booked for indecent exposure, for assault and battery, for kicking in his windshield, for hitting her, for hitting him, all the delightful little antics that we pull as practicing alcoholics. And I will never forget how humiliating it was to be in that courtroom the very next morning when my brother-in-law, the public defender in Lincoln, who was working in Palmyra that day, I didn't know he was there, walked up to me, and he said, Karen, have you lost your marbles or what? You know, what in the hell is wrong with you? Why would you do something like this? And you guys, I looked at my brother-in-law, and I was to say this to many, many people in my drinking career in many, many courtrooms. I said, oh, for Christ's sakes, Dennis, this could happen to anybody. You know, and... And we all know better than that. And that cost me about $3,000 to get out of that. And I just shirked it off like it was no big deal. You're going to drink, these things are going to happen occasionally, so what? I will never forget what it felt like to wake up in the very hospital that I worked at in surgery, one more time out of a blackout, one more time I'd been to horse races. You know, for a number of years, I thought the horse races were my problem. It certainly was not my drinking. And I'm one of these alcoholic females with a big mouth when I drink, and I have a big mouth in sobriety, but I can tell you that pain as a teacher is getting a lot better. And I'd smart off some guy at that horse race track, and he belted me right in the teeth is what he did. And a plastic surgeon was putting 18 stitches in my mouth. And I'll never forget what this doctor said to me as long as I live. I'll never forget this. He said, Karen, we love you so much. What is wrong with you? You are such a good nurse and stuff. We think you're an alcoholic. Let's send you to a treatment center and get this drinking problem taken care of so you can get on with your life here. And you guys, I could not believe the audacity this man had that he would say that to me. And I said, just fix my lip and get the hell out of my face. I'll drink if I want to drink. And that's exactly what I did. And the drunk driving charges and the bad checks, all the stuff that we do. My kids were in trouble. I never could marry these guys I was engaged to. They kept dying from alcoholism. And I thought to myself, I need to get married to my ex-husband again. That's what I need to do. The kids need their father. Besides that, I need to get even with him for all the things that he's done to me. And those are not very good reasons to get married again, I got to tell you guys. And I'm certainly not proud of that as I stand here tonight. And, you know, if anybody in this room is thinking about getting married to the same person twice, don't do it. You're going to be sorry. The only way I can describe it is like taking a bite out of the same turd twice, if you will. And I'm sure he feels the same way I do. As a matter of fact, I know he does. And I danced that man through three of the most miserable years of his life on the face of this earth. And I love to tell you guys this story I'm about ready to tell you. And my sponsor always tells me that is not funny, and you should not be telling that from AA podiums. And I always say, okay, Clancy, I won't tell it anymore. And he said, no, go ahead and tell it. Those people see how sick you really were, and apparently how sick you really still are. And I'm still sick and I still think it's funny and I'm telling the story. When I married him again, I told him, I said, if you ever hit me again, buddy, I'm going to kill you the next time you hit me. And he said, I'll never hit you again ever. And I said, you better see that you don't. And he lied is what he did. And he came home drunk one night. And I happened to be sober this night for some reason. And I'll never know why, because I usually wasn't. And girls, you know what guys do when they come home drunk. They want to take you to bed and stuff. And I was not buying it. If there's anything I can't stand, it's some drunk man mauling me when I'm sober. I will say that when the shoe's on the other foot, though, it's fine with me. And that guy came home and indicated that to me. And I said, you get your hands off me and leave me alone. I wanted nothing to do with him, period. And he broke my arm is what he did. And I'm here to tell you guys that I was pissed. Make no mistake about that. As a matter of fact, I'm still pissed about it, if you want to know the truth. And I told him, I said, you go to sleep on that couch, and so help me God, when you wake up, you're going to wish you'd never been born. And he sat up for hours, you guys, his eyes pried open. And as it must be, he finally passed out. And I started drinking martinis, and this is a classic example of what alcohol did for me. Alcohol told me what to do. I didn't tell it what to do. And I had about 8-10 martinis, and I was feeling no pain, I got to tell you. And I was sitting there watching this guy. And I hate to tell you what this man was doing, but I can't tell you the story unless I tell you what he was doing. He was laying on the couch playing with himself. And I thought, you disgusting man, you make me sick to my stomach. And the more I drank, the madder I got. And you guys, you know, I'm a nurse, and I'm very familiar with male anatomy. And I'd be very familiar with male anatomy if I wasn't a nurse, you know. But anyway, I thought to myself, what can I do to get even with this guy for all the things that he's done to me? And I came up with this brilliant idea in my drunken stupor. You know, that's one thing that we should never do is drink and think at the same time, I got to tell you. One or the other, but not both going at the same time. And this is about 18 years ago, you guys, when superglue first came out. And superglue was powerful stuff. You did not want to screw around with superglue. Mrs. Bobbitt has nothing on me, I got to tell you. I was a foreigner before that lady ever thought about what she did, and proud of it, too, I might add. But anyway, I got that super glue out, and I read the directions on that super glue. And like I said, I was drunk, and I wasn't seeing very clearly. And what I thought those directions said were, if this hits human skin, you'll be left in 15 hours. Now, why would it say something stupid like that? What it said was, in fact, if this hits human skin, you'd be left within 5 minutes, is what it said. And I went over to this guy, and I poured super glue all over this guy's groin, and I mean everywhere. There was not... There was not... There was not... There was not one place this man that did not have super glue. You know what I'm laughing about, Linda? All these guys are giving me dirty looks in here. There was not one place this man that did not have super glue. And I laughed about it and I went to bed. And I woke up in the morning to screams of horror like you cannot even believe. And I did not mean to... I did not mean to hurt this guy as bad as I did. I swear to God that's true, but... I'll tell you what happened to my ex-husband. This guy never had the advantage of being circumcised when he was born, and now he clearly was, I can tell you that. Scott, shut up. They're making me laugh. We had a telephone by our bedroom, there in Lincoln. He called the police, and the cops were in front of our home with their sirens going. There was an ambulance out there. The neighbors were gawking out of their windows. And, you know, one thing you guys got to keep in mind here, they do not see things like this happen in Lincoln, Nebraska. In California, it wouldn't surprise me one bit, but certainly not there. And the cops were laughing, which led me to believe the whole thing was funny. And they said, lady, are you crazy or what? Why would you do something like this? And you guys, I looked at those cops, and I was to say this to many, many people in my drinking career. What the hell makes you think that I did it anyway? You know, I was only standing there with glue on my hands, for Christ's sakes, you know, they said, you're under arrest for assault and battery. And I said, you can't arrest wives in Nebraska for assault and battery against their husbands. I knew better than that. And 2 days later when I got out of jail, I guess I didn't know better than that. They took that man to the very hospital that I worked at in surgery, and he had to have surgery. And one more time, the whole staff saw what Karen did. And they took me to jail, I might add. And it turned out to be a terrible, terrible thing. Those doctors there in Lincoln couldn't get that glue off. And they had to get two surgeons down from Creighton University Medical School in Omaha, Nebraska to get that glue off. And, you know, there's a paper written about that at Creighton. And if anybody in this room is thinking about going to medical school there, you can read about it if you want to. I'd always wanted a paper written about me, but not like this, I got to tell you. And I was sitting in that jail thinking to myself, I'm getting the hell out of this marriage, because when this guy comes home from the hospital, he's going to glue something to mine shut. And he would have, too, I got to tell you. And And God only knows I couldn't have that happen. You know, I know. And I divorced that man one more time. And I will tell you guys on the brighter side of things for tonight that Alcoholics Anonymous really does work. Because we have an immense step in this program. And my sponsor made me get on an airplane and fly to Sacramento, California and make amends to my ex-husband where he currently lives here in your town. And I tried to tell my sponsor I'm not sorry that I did that. Therefore, I don't have to make the amends. He said, I don't give a damn whether you're sorry or not. Get on the airplane and do what I'm asking you to do. Maybe one of these days you will be sorry. And so I flew to Sacramento, you guys, and I made amends to that man. And I need to tell you that, you know, he kind of backs up when he sees me, I got to tell you. But we were able to sit down and talk and stuff. And I walked away from that guy. I was free of what I had done to him. I was free of being married to him twice. And I can tell you guys that the promises in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous started coming true in my life when I made those amends. So I know that this thing works. You just got to do it for it to work. And, you know, I want to tell you guys that little story that goes along with that tonight. And this is a recent thing that's just happened in my life. And I love to share it with members of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, there's no greater power than the power of example in AA, I got to tell you. And, you know, I made those amends to that guy about 5 years ago here in Sacramento. And in about a year, and we don't talk. Denny and I have nothing to do with each other. And we were absolutely incompatible. But although we're very much in love with each other, if you want to know the truth, we just did not get along. There will not be a third time in my life, I got to tell you. We get along good in bed, but outside of bed, we don't even talk, I got to tell you. And anyway, he called me about a year ago, and he said, you know, I'm really having trouble. I can't quit drinking. I can't quit using drugs. And you know, you guys, I wanted to come up here. I wanted to manage the whole thing, find some people in AA up here and try and fix it for him, you know. And AA kicked in for me big time, and I found myself saying to this man, call Sacramento AA, Dean. That's what you need to do. And I gave him a couple numbers up here, and apparently he used those numbers and stuff. And I didn't hear any more from him and stuff. And in May, on my AA birthday in May, I got a dozen red roses from this guy, and I want to tell you what he wrote on this card to me. He said, happy AA 12th birthday. Nobody but people in AA say things like that, I got to tell you, and which led me to believe that this guy was sober and stuff. And, you know, I talked to my sponsor. My sponsor said, don't you even respond to those flowers. The last thing that man needs in his life is you, let me tell you. And, you know, he's early on in sobriety, and you just stay the hell out of him. And I followed my sponsor's direction. And about 6 weeks ago, I got a call from that man. And he told me, and this is so funny, you guys, he says to me, how dare you talk about me on that tape that you make, you know, and apparently you heard one of my tapes and stuff, and I said, you know what, Denny, when you get to be 12 years sober, you can make a tape about me, and you can say anything you want to, you know, and he told me, he says, you're going to be speaking in Sacramento in December, aren't you, and I said, yeah, and he said, you know, I think I'll come to that, but I don't see him here tonight, but I wish he was here so I could point him out to you, I can tell you that, but anyway, that man is 6 months sober. That man is 6 months sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the best thing about it, you guys, is that I wish him well. I really wish that man well. That's what you've done for me. And he told me, he said, let's go have coffee afterwards. And I said, Denny, I don't date newcomers, and I don't date married men. You know, no, absolutely not. But anyway, I'm so glad to be here tonight, and I'm so glad that he's sober, and I'm so glad that I made it amends to that guy. You know, I'm not sure that would have ever happened to him, you guys, if I hadn't. So anyway, you know, and I found myself getting involved with the most bizarre man I ever met before in my life. This guy told me he was in the mafia. Now, I don't think anybody in Lincoln, Nebraska is in the mafia, for Christ's sakes. And I was lying to him, and he was lying to me. It was your typical alcoholic nightmare is what it was. I was drinking on a daily basis. I was starting to take Valium for severe tremors I was starting to have. It was beginning to be no more fun to be doing it, I got to tell you guys. You know, I love the bars, and I love the men, I love the sex, I love the music, I love all the crap that goes on in there. I feel like a glove, and I particularly like what goes on after the bars close, if you want to know the truth. And like I said earlier, drinking for me at one time was a fun, fun thing. It would be a lie for me to say anything but that. But like I said earlier, I cannot remember the fun, I have to remember the pain that caused me. It almost cost me my life. And you guys, I'm a nurse, and I've studied alcoholism, and I knew all about it before I became one. And it shows me one more time tonight that self-knowledge does not mean a damn thing with this disease. It's action that counts. Nowhere in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous do we have a chapter called Into Thinking. But we do have one that's called Into Action. And that's the only reason I'm standing here 12 years sober, I got to tell you. And, you know, I can't even believe the way I used to think about this disease. I'll get on top of it. I know all about it. I'll stop in time. And I was hooked, you guys. And I mean, I was in this thing big time. I literally could not quit drinking. And the day came for me, the hospital told me, we have had all the crap we're going to take off of you. We cannot read about our nursing staff in the paper anymore. Gluing husbands, drunk driving charges, bad checks, all the stuff that you're doing. Everything that you do in Nebraska is in the paper, I'm sorry to say. And they knew my game, let me tell you. And they said, you're either going to a treatment center or you no longer have this job. And you guys, you you know, you don't tell people like me that stuff. And I said, you and what army's going to make me go to a treatment center? And I walked out of a job that I loved more than in the whole world, and I cannot say that enough tonight. And I drank and I drank and I died 1,000 times over. I went to work at a nursing home there in Lincoln. And what I'm about ready to tell you guys is something I'm not proud to discuss from any AA podium. It took me years into my sobriety before I would ever mention this. I found myself stealing drugs from that nursing home. I was stealing morphine and Demerol and cocaine and Valium, and then I get my damn hands on. And if you think I'm proud of that, you are sadly mistaken. And the day came for me, the people that ran that place came up to me, and they said, Karen, what is wrong with you? You are just weird is what you are. And, you know, you're a good nurse and stuff. You take good care of the patients, but you're just strange. And I remember thinking to myself, you'd be strange, too, if you had 200 milligrams of Demerol on board. You'd be strange, too. And I threw my narcotic keys at them, and I walked out the door before they fired me. And I work at Bryan Memorial Hospital there in Lincoln. And you guys, it's a fine, fine facility. And I was drunk on that interview, and I got that nursing position. And I'm not talking down about falling down drunk. I was just maintaining a certain level in my bloodstream that I would not shake and have those violent tremors. That is clearly desperation drinking. Our book describes it vividly. And I was in hot water up to my yin-yang, let me tell you. I had to drink. I had to take drugs. And I had no more choice in any of it. And I will tell you guys right up front here tonight that I hated myself so bad I cannot begin to tell you. It was something I had to do. And I would justify in my head, I don't mean to do this. I'm not a bad person. This is a temporary thing. I'm never going to do it again. I literally could not function without alcohol and drugs on board at all times, I got to tell you. I could not go 3 hours without at least 3 or 4 shots of vodka in my system. And that is pretty bad stuff, let me tell you guys. And, you know, I don't know how many people in this room have been through withdrawal, but I can tell you it is not a pleasant experience. And I went through that on a daily basis for a long, long time. And I drank to stop those shakes. I knew, just like our book describes, if I didn't get that drink inside of me, I knew that I would die and stuff. And anyway, I kept that job for a short amount of time, doing the same things I was doing at that nursing home, stealing drugs, justifying in my head, I don't mean to do this, I'm not a bad person, this is a temporary thing, and on and on and on. And the day got caught for me, that I got caught red-handed stealing some morphine from that hospital. And this has got to be, without a doubt, the most humiliating day of my entire life. When they said, you give us your narcotic keys and you get out of this hospital and don't you ever walk back here and here again. We're reporting this to the State Board of Nursing Nebraska. That's exactly what they did. That's exactly what they should have done. My other two jobs should have done it too, as a matter of fact. And to make a long story short from here tonight, I lost my nursing license. I threw the one thing that I loved more than anything in the whole world right down the toilet so I could drink. And that is total insanity. It's also called alcoholism. And there's a reason for that, you guys. The alcohol had to have it all. It had to take every single thing I had before I would pay attention to this, and then some too. And to make a long story short and short from here tonight, I wound up on the streets of Nebraska is what happened to me. And you guys, I spent 2 years on the streets, and I have traveled over the Midwest. I prostituted myself, and I'll guarantee you one thing, that I have seen and done things that no woman should ever see or do. And I'm so, so sick in the head sometimes, I think to myself, I wouldn't mind seeing some of them again, you know. And my sponsor assures me. Still a very ill person to be thinking that kind of crap. And excuse me. And 2 years went by for me, and you know, I've been in nut houses, I've been in detoxes, I've been in jails, I've been in institutions. I cannot think of a thing that happened to me out in those streets as a practicing female alcoholic. And things happened to me I would not repeat from an AA podium, I got to tell you guys. And 2 years went by for me, and there I was back there in Lincoln, standing on Skid Row, sucking on a bottle of Mad Dog. And I certainly have better things intended for myself than to be doing that, I got to tell you. I will never forget that last day of my drinking as long as I live, and I hope to God it was the last day of my drinking. I apparently was so physically sick I just passed out in the streets is what happened to me. But before that happened, I remember thinking to myself, you know, there was a Hilton Hotel adjacent to that Skid Row area, and I remember thinking 2 years ago, I used to stand on top of the Hilton Hotel and drink martinis with surgeons. What am I doing standing on Skid Row drinking with these people? And I rather imagine those people felt the same way when they arrived there. And like I said, I can't tell you much about it at all. I woke up in an intensive care ward at the very hospital that I was born at, the very hospital that I worked at for 19 years, and I can tell you guys,
right from the front here. I found myself in withdrawal that was so bad I cannot begin to tell you. You know, I'm not a very big person. I only weighed 95 pounds the day I got sober, and I was coming off a quarter whatever a day and 200 milligrams of Valium a day. And that is a lot of booze, and that is a lot of pills, and I had a lot of dying to do. You know, they say that most alcohol withdrawal is over within 3 days, and perhaps it is for some people. It certainly was not for me. It was going to be a long, long time before I was going to start feeling better. And I had tubes come out of my belly. They were draining fluid off my liver. I had IVs going, and I just wanted to die is what I wanted to do. And obviously, I couldn't even do that. And I laid in that intensive care ward, and I shook, and I shook, and I died, and I died for one solid month. And you know, I used to scream at those nurses and say, you get me some Librium, you get me some Valium, you get me something. This is absolutely inhumane. Anybody should have to go through this kind of withdrawal. And they said, Karen, listen to us. You need to fill every one of those tremors, and maybe you'll never do it again. I went to a fine, fine facility, you guys. They knew exactly what they were doing with alcoholics, and they went on to tell me, there's nothing wrong with your heart. It's not throwing any irregularities. You need to fill every one of those tremors, and maybe you'll never do it again. And I did not want to hear that, let me tell you. But let me tell you what these people did for me. And I will be forever grateful as long as I am sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. They got about 10 people from AA to come and sit with me. And these people never left me day or night for 30 solid days. And I fell in love with these members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll tell you why. There was nobody in my life the day I got sober. My family wanted nothing to do with me. They've been through it too many times. They were not going to go through it one more time. My mom, who I love very, very much, you guys, had to be hospitalized because of me and put on tranquilizers. And I have not forgotten that by a long shot as I stand here tonight. My mom did not deserve that, you guys. And although my mom is dead, I have to make constant living amends to that woman. And I think I can do that by being a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous and stuff. And so for the first time in a long time, people were talking to me again. And these people would sit in by the hour and they would say things like, Karen, just keep breathing. That's all you got to do is breathe. And I'd say, when is this withdrawal going to stop? And they said, when it's time, that's when it's going to stop. And that wasn't good enough for me. I wanted a date is what I wanted. And they couldn't give me a date. And they're absolutely accurate about that. When it's time, it's time. And at 30 days of sobriety, I walked in that official treatment program at that hospital. I'm a product of a treatment center. I have no opinion on one way or the other. But apparently I went to a fine one because all they talked about was Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's a lot of bad ones out there, you guys. And thank God I went to a good one. And let me tell you what I was like when I was 30 days sober. I needed you so desperately on day one. But 30 days there was a whole different ball game when you started telling me what to do. And I don't know how many people in this room tonight have been through group therapy. But I'll tell you what, it is not a pleasant experience, I can tell you that. And I walked into that group, and there was 14 men in that group, and they were all younger than I was, in there for drunk driving charges and stuff like that. I couldn't identify with these people. I'd done those things years prior to my alcoholism. And this one guy looked at me, and he said, you think you're better than everybody else here, don't you? And I made a comment to this man that I was to pay for a long, long time in that treatment center. I said, yeah, you asshole, and you can put your name at the top of the list. As a direct result of that comment, I found myself in an inpatient 30-day program for 7 months, you guys. And that is a long time to be in an inpatient 30-day program. And I completed that program, and I went to an outpatient program. I went to an evening care program. I went to an aftercare program. And I found myself a very, very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous in Lincoln. And I wasn't doing one thing the way that you teach people in AA to do it. I would tell the new people, you don't need to read the book, and you don't need a sponsor. We can do whatever the hell we want to do around here. This is an individual program. And needless to say, I was not real popular with the old-timers in Lincoln, Nebraska. And I rapidly went through 19 sponsors in that town. And I need to tell you guys right here tonight that the old-timers in AA are so precious to me as I stand here tonight. But not in 1982. I could have cared less one way than what these people thought. And, you know, God loved the mean old-timers in Alcoholics Anonymous. They literally saved my life. And they're dying off right and left, I got to tell you guys. And they have taught me well, I got to tell you. And you know, you can pull your crap in here just for so long, and these old-timers are going to start nailing you one right after the other. And this old guy with 29 years of sobriety grabbed me out of an AA meeting one day, and he said, come outside, I want to talk to you. He said, you stay away from the new people. How dare you tell the new people in AA they don't need the book and they don't need a sponsor? He said, you're like a typhoid Mary in AA. Everybody dies around you, but you're able to stay sober somehow. And he said, you stay away from the new people. And he went on to tell me, there's going to be a man from California speaking in Kearney, Nebraska this weekend. His name is Clancy. You're going to hear this man speak. You're going to ask this man if he will sponsor you. He is a master at dealing with jerks like you. And I'd heard all about Clancy, and I wanted nothing to do with him, period, because I knew I was going to be in bad, bad trouble. And I got to tell you, my fears have been justified 8,000 times over. And I told this old-timer, I said, who the hell do you think you are that you're going to tell me he's going to be my sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous? He said, if you don't get in that car and go with us Saturday, I'm going to tell everybody in Lincoln how you stole money from an AA meeting. And I'll guarantee I was in that car going to Kearney, Nebraska. And I paid that money back, too, by the way. And I got to tell you guys that from a podium in Kearney, Nebraska, that Clancy literally, and I mean literally, put the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous into my life. And my life has never been the same since that talk. And there's a reason for that. For the first time in my sobriety, I was identifying with another alcoholic. And as I understand Alcoholics Anonymous, that's what this thing is all about. I know of no finer speaker in the world than my sponsor. I'm not saying that you need to believe that. It's only important that I believe that. And by the end of that talk, I wanted that man for my sponsor. That, ladies and gentlemen, is how God works in Karen's life. I never would have asked that man to sponsor me in a million years. Trust me on that, I never would have asked him. I found myself walking across that convention floor and asking him to be my sponsor. And he looked at me and he said, I don't sponsor crazy people like you. And that's a lie anyway. He sponsors people crazier than I ever thought of being. And I thought to myself, why did he say that to me? He doesn't even know me. And I wasn't aware of the fact this old-timer called him 2 weeks prior to him coming to Link, said at Carney, and asked him if they brought me, if he would talk to me. And he said, of course I will. And he knew my game, let me tell you. And I was standing in my little white dress on, my little white gloves on, acting like an angel. And he saw right through my crap, I got to tell you. And thank God he saw through my crap. And he said, Karen, I don't like to sponsor people on a long-distance basis, but I'm going to do this for you, because if I don't do it for you, you're probably going to go die somewhere. But he said, I'm going to tell you something, little girl, and you better listen to me real good, because I'm going to say it one time and one time only. You're going to call me today, and I tell you not to call me every day. You're going to read that book. You're going to sponsor people. You're going to become an active, vital member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're not going to argue with me. You're not going to defend your actions to me. You're going to do what I ask you to do. And if you don't want to do that, then get yourself a different sponsor. And you guys, you want to talk about we stood at the turning point. This is the day. This is the day when my recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous began. And I almost said two words. I almost fell over when I said them. I said, yes, sir. And I'll guarantee you that I say it today, too. Respect's got to start from me somewhere. It might as well start with my sponsor in this program. I went back to Lincoln. I became very, very active in AA in the right way. And I went up by sponsoring 56 women in that town. And I'm not bragging about that. It's not that much fun to sponsor 56 crazy women in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I grew to love these women very, very much. And I'll tell you why. They literally showed me the first 4 years of my sobriety what to do and what not to do in this program. And every one of those women are still sober today. It's not because of me. It's because of their active Bible members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the first directions my sponsor gave me, I want you to get that nursing license back. And I tried to tell this man, I cannot go through that kind of humiliation. And he said, Karen, are you arguing with me? And I said, no. He said, get up to the State Board of Nursing, Nebraska. Tell those people that you have been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for almost 2 years, that you'd like the opportunity to get your nursing license back. And you guys, I knew it wasn't going to work, but I did it anyway. And that's without a doubt the most important thing I can say in this room tonight. I did what my sponsor asked me to do, whether I thought it would work or not. And I went up there and asked them for my license back. And they looked at me like I had just grown horns on the top of my head, I got to tell you. And they said, how many links are you willing to go to? And I had to do a lot, you guys. I had to take crap off people for 2 years that I wouldn't hire to mow my own lawn, if you want to know the truth. And I had to keep my mouth shut in the process. And one of the happiest days of my life occurred about 8.5 years ago, when one more time I was jerked in front of the State Board of Nursing, Nebraska. And what they told me literally brought my knees for the first time in Alcoholics Anonymous. They said, welcome home. You're fully reinstated as a registered nurse. And that is a gift from AA. I do not deserve that. No. I had absolutely not one thing to do with it. You guys did that for me, I got to tell you. And this program is so powerful, you guys. I cannot begin to tell you. And doing the actions here and trying to practice these principles got that nursing license back for me. And I will be forever grateful to you for that, let me tell you. And which led me to believe that this whole thing really does indeed work and stuff. And I was really ready to start doing some work here and stuff. And you know, and I came out here to visit a couple times. I started chasing a dream. I fell in love with Southern California AA. And I truly believe that I am in the mecca of Alcoholics Anonymous in the whole world. And if you don't believe it, come to San Diego in 1995 for the World Conference, and you're going to believe it too. And we are expecting 100,000 people at that conference in that stadium, and I hope that you all get to come. I know that I'm going to be there, and it's a magnificent experience. It's one that none of us should ever miss as a World Conference. But anyway, I told Clancy on the phone one day, I want to move to Southern California. I want to belong to the Pacific Group. I want to live on that crazy Venice Beach with all those crazy people. I knew I'd fit like a glove, and I've not been wrong about that either. I want to work at UCLA in the operating room. I want to be on two of their transplant teams, their heart and liver transplant teams. I want this and I want that. And every single one of those things have come true for me. And those are all gifts from AA. I do not deserve any of it, but I intend to take it. I can tell you that. And I wanted to share with you guys a couple of quick stories before I sit down. And these are stories I love to share with members of Alcoholics Anonymous, because then I get to relive them all over again. And early on, my sponsor asked me, he said, Karen, where are you at with your spiritual program? And I said, Clancy, I don't have a spiritual program. I don't believe in God. I can't do that stuff. And this is when I still lived in Nebraska. And he flipped open the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous over the telephone, and he read to me where it says, I get a daily reprieve contingent on a spiritual maintenance with a power greater than myself. And he went on to tell me, there's going to come a day in your sobriety when I can't help you, AA can't help you, and you had better well have a God in your life, or you're going to be dead from the disease of alcoholism. And I believe that as I stand up here tonight, you guys, because it's happened to me many, many times in my sobriety. And thank God I had a God by the time it happened. And one more time, I said to my sponsor, what do you want me to do? He said, I want you to get on your knees in the morning. I want you to get on your knees at night. And I want you to pray for God's will. Do not pray for things. Pray for God's will and the power to carry that out. And I started doing that, you guys, and I didn't feel any connection with God. I felt like a fool doing it, if you want to know the truth. And you know, and I would talk to this man every day on the phone, and I'd say, this is not working for me, Clancy. And he'd say, are you staying sober one day at a time in Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, well, you know that I am. He said, that's the point of the whole thing. Are you stupid or what? I wasn't playing with a full deck when I arrived here. It took me a long, long time to get these little simple things. And in 1985, I found myself in Montreal, Canada, at the World Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd driven up there from Nebraska with two people I sponsor. They didn't want to go to this thing. And I said, well, you are going because I can't afford to go by myself. And we only had $200 apiece. We had no place to stay. Those hotels were like $100 a night. But by God, I was going to that World Conference. If I had to sleep outside, I was going to that World Conference. And we got up to the convention center. We found an apartment to rent for the whole week for $100. I could not believe our good luck. And I found myself in a great big football stadium at that Friday night meeting. And there was 56,000 sober alcoholics in that football stadium. And I was in awe of Alcoholics Anonymous, I need to tell you guys, in absolute awe of this program. And everybody was up having a wonderful, wonderful time and stuff. They were down there on the football field. They were practicing for a flag ceremony. Alcoholics from all over the world carrying their national flags. And I know this all sounds real corny to the new people, but the longer I stay sober, the cornier I get for some reason. And my sponsor was down there helping them practice for that flag ceremony. And I ran down to tell Clancy hi and introduced me to people from all over the world in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you guys, I'm from Nebraska, and I was impressed, let me tell you. And I'm impressed today by people from all over the world in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I ran back up and joined my friends, and that flag ceremony started. And I will never forget this. As long as I live, I'll never forget this. When the United States of America's flag touched the turf of that stadium, I saw 56,000 sober people go absolutely crazy. And I looked around myself, and I did not see one dry eye in that football stadium. I saw those old-timers sitting around, all the new people and all the people in between. And they all seemed to be loving this program so very, very much. And I remember thinking to myself, what is wrong with me? Why can't I feel what these people are feeling? I, too, wanted to love AA, you guys, and I could not seem to achieve it somehow. And for the first time in my life, I got tears in my eyes. I did not try and stop. And for the first time, with any amount of sincerity whatsoever, I said, God, thank you for getting me here. Please help me to stay here. Please help me to love this program as much as these people do. And I will tell you guys that I cried and I cried and I cried. And I will tell you that in a foreign country, in a foreign land, I came to believe, just like the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says, I came to believe in a power greater than myself by watching and being with the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I really believe the old adage that we see when we're ready to see, we hear when we're ready to hear, and not before. And I believe the actions my sponsor gave me got me to that point. And I will tell you that for one solid second, my world stopped. And I remember that woman who was standing on Skid Row in Lincoln, Nebraska, who literally could not quit drinking, who literally could not. And there she was, 3.5 years sober. I personally believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is divinely inspired. I'm not saying that you should believe that. It's only important that I believe that and stuff. And like I said, I have talked to that God every day sincerely since, because I believe what my sponsor has taught me. I get a daily reprieve. You guys, I work at UCLA, and I have a magnificent job, but it's just a damn job is what it is. My sponsor has taught me that God and AA have got to be center core of my very existence. Not some man, not some job. It's God and AA. Everything else revolves around that. And I believe that as I stand here tonight. Through many, many painful experiences, I've discovered that to be true. And I love to tell this story. I absolutely love to tell this story. And about 7 years ago in Southern California, we had a terrible nursing crisis. And we were working our butts off, let me tell you. And I was always the first one to complain about it, I'm sorry to say. And this one particular week, I'd worked 72 hours. And, you know, we're too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. I was a bitch is what I was. And I worked the night shift over there. And I had the night off that night. And I went to a meeting earlier in the evening. I went home and I went to bed early. And my boss called me about 2 o'clock in the morning. And my boss makes Clancy look like a pussycat, I got to tell you. And this woman's probably the finest nurse I've ever been before in my life. And one of these days when I grow up, I want to be just like her and stuff. And anyway, she called me and she said, I got 18 people sick over here tonight. We're going to do a transplant on a little girl that's about 3 years old. I need you to come over here and help me. I know you've worked 72 hours. I know you're not on call tonight. I need your help. And I said, I am not coming over there. And she hung up on me is what she did. And, you know, my sponsor's taught me to do what's in front of me and not debate it, you guys. And that was clearly in front of me, let me tell you. And he said, just do what God gives you to do and quit debating it, you know. And I was going to call Clancy, but I don't want to talk to Clancy about nothing at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I know what he'd have told me anyway, go to work, you know. And I'm so glad that I did and stuff. And he always tells me, nobody ever died from lack of sleep, Karen, you know. And I always want to say, well, there's a first time for everything, Clancy, you know. But anyway, I went to work, and I'm so glad that I did and stuff. And And I got over there. I sent my orderly upstairs. We were going to do a liver transplant on this little girl that was about 3 years old. And he brought this little girl down to surgery. We had a jet coming in from the East Coast with a liver for this child. We had some time to kill and stuff. And he brought my little patient down. And he said, "Karen, come out front. You're not going to believe all the people that are with this family." And I thought, well, that's nice that they have the support. And I was so crabby, you guys. You have no idea. And I went out front, and the first thing I noticed was the mother. She had the most beautiful blue eyes I've ever seen before in my life. And the dad was good-looking and stuff. And there was about 75 people with this family. And I thought, how highly unusual at 4 o'clock in the morning. How highly unusual any time, as a matter of fact. And there was something about these people, you guys. I was drawn to these people. I was absolutely drawn to these people. And they were being tremendous support to this family. And that mom and dad were in absolute hysterics, I got to tell you. And I looked down at my little patient. And I got to tell you guys that Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me to love at a level that I never, ever, ever dreamt possible for myself. And I looked in the most beautiful blue eyes I've ever seen before in my life. And this little girl was so sick, she couldn't even lift her head off the pillow. She was so sick and dying from some strange liver thing. And I bent over and I talked to her. And in her arms, she had a little bear, and she had a blanket wrapped around that bear. And she was hanging on to him for dear life, I got to tell you guys. And I bent over and I said, "Oh, you brought your little bear down to surgery." And she tried to tell me her little bear was going to have a liver transplant. And I said, "Oh, you're both going to have one." And she said, no, just the bear, you know. And we sent the family out to the waiting room. And that little girl looked at me and she said, "Why is my mommy crying? Go tell my mommy not to cry. I can't stand it when my mommy cries." And because of Alcoholics Anonymous and what I've learned in this program, I was able to tell that little girl the truth. And I said, "Your mommy's crying because your mommy loves you so much and stuff." And that seemed to settle her down, you guys. And we put that little girl to sleep. And I got to tell you guys that 16-hour liver transplant did not go well. We almost lost that baby a couple times due to blood loss and stuff. I have never seen an operating team full of people pull together like we pulled together for that baby that night. And 16 hours later, she went up to her room, and really with not too much hope at all, I got to tell you guys, we were very, very scared for this child's life. And I became obsessed with this little baby girl, and I had to see her again. And we have a rule at UCLA. You may not get involved with these transplant patients. They want to know the organs come from. We cannot tell them. It's best not to see them after surgery. And I don't need to tell anybody in this room tonight that I'm real good at breaking rules now, aren't I? And I thought, I'm just going to go up and see how she's doing. I'm not going to talk to anybody. And I thought about it for 6 days, and I thought, that's what I'm going to do. And I went upstairs, and I opened the door to that child's room. And you guys, I could not believe what was in front of my face. My God, the power of God, the power of God. There was this little baby girl with big blue eyes, and it was the first time she'd been up since her surgery. She was jumping up and down in her crib. She had her diapers hanging around her knees. She had that bear in one arm. And she put Band-Aids all over this bear. He had Band-Aids on his eyes, his ears, his nose, and I mean everywhere, let me tell you. And the other hand, she had a baby bottle. And it was, like I said, it was the first time she'd been up. She was just jumping up and down and stuff. That a whole room full of people were in there. And I thought, oh, my God. And I just stood there and cried. And, you know, it's not cool for the nursing staff to stand there and bawl, you guys. And they were all looking at me real strange and stuff. And something caught my eye out of the corner of my eye. And I'll be damned if our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, wasn't sitting on that kid's dresser. Now, if you think I'm going to stay out of that room, I didn't give a damn if I got fired. And I was in that room like a fast flash, and I said to the mother, I said, "Whose book is that?" And she said, "Well, that's my book. I'm a member of AA, and so is my husband." And her sponsor was there, and his sponsor was there. And those 75 people, you guys, had driven 500 miles to be with this family. They were not from the L.A. area. And they showed me one more time what this deal was all about. It's about love and service, and that's all that it's about. And I was impressed, let me tell you. And I said to the mother, I said, "How long have you been sober?" And she said, "5 years today." And I thought, oh, my God, a little girl up for the first time. What a fabulous, fabulous birthday present. And I walked over to this little child, and she looked at me, and she stopped dead in her tracks. She says, "Go away. I'm not sick anymore." I was standing there in my scrub clothes, and it scared the hell out of her is what it did. And I said, "I didn't come up here to hurt you. I just came up here to see how you're doing." And you guys, she handed me her little bear, and she said, "You take him home and take care of him. He's so sick, he needs a nurse to take care of him." And I told the mother, I said, "I can't take that child's bear home." You guys, we had that child's bear by that little girl's head the whole time of her surgery, and we had him in a plastic bag, and we made sure that nothing bad got on that bear. And we wanted that bear to be with her whole surgery. And I told the mother, I said, "You really need to keep that bear as a memento, you know." And she said, "Karen, please take it. She wants you to have it. She's got 50 bears in this room." And she did indeed have 50 bears in that room. And I felt like a fool walking down the hall with that bear. But I got to tell you that bear is my most prized possession in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought to myself, I need to reciprocate here. And I obviously was not prepared for a birthday party. And I remember something was in my pocket that's my Clancy gave me when I was 5 years sober, and it was a medallion for 5 years of sobriety, and I was 7 years sober, you guys, when this happened. And we say in Alcoholics Anonymous that you've got to give this away to keep it. You have got to give it away. And I could not seem to find the person that was special enough, in my opinion, to give my 5-year medallion to. And I knew I had found the person, you guys. I knew I had found the person. And I walked over to her, and I told her the history of my medallion. And she says, oh, Karen, I can't take that. My God, Clancy gave you that. You know, I just can't. And I said, please take it. I want you to have it. And I really, really meant that, you guys. And we got a cake. The nurses got wind of all this. We got a cake for the mother, and we celebrated her 5 years of sobriety. And I got my sponsor on the telephone. I had never seen Clancy so excited in my whole life. And, he had about 50 cars in front of UCLA. It happened to be Wednesday. And I was so very, very proud, you guys, to take most people to my home group in Alcoholics Anonymous that night, the Pacific group. I will never forget those people as long as I live. There's been no more contact with them. It's got to be that way for many, many reasons. But I know that little girl is doing very, very well. And you know, I could have missed all that, you guys. I could have missed all that. If it had been left at my own devices, I never would have gotten out of bed that night, I got to tell you. And I wonder how many times things like this has happened in my life that I've missed because of my own self-will run riot, you know. And you know, people say to me all the time, why do you keep doing it, Karen? Why do you keep doing it? And I know of no greater thing to say to them, so that this to the end, that my great blessings may never spoil me, that I may forever live in thankful contemplation to him who presides over us all. And there's more reasons than that. You're the ones that walked with me when nobody else would walk with me. You held my hand when nobody else would hold my hand. And you told me that you loved me. And I need you as desperately tonight as I needed you in 1982. You've taught me how to live. You've taught me how to love. You've taught me how to keep my pants up and all those things. And I don't do any of those things. I don't do any of those things very well. But I'll tell you the one thing that I do with 200% absolute perfection, and that is this, that I love you more than anything in the whole world. And it's truly a story from an alcoholic hell I cannot even describe. I have truly been given, just like the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says, I have truly been given the keys to the kingdom. And I'm going to say one more thing, and I'm going to sit down here. It has been one hell of a walk from Skid Row in Nebraska to where I stand tonight in Sacramento, California. And I think that but for the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous that I would have missed it all. Thank you for having me, and thank you for my life.